All right, welcome back, everyone. This is another episode of Real World Serverless podcast. And today I'm joined by Waldemar Hammer, who is the CTO of LocalStack. Hey, man, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back. I think we had one session a couple of months ago. It was really a pleasure, and it's great to be here on the show with you today.
Yeah, we did. I forgot that it wasn't a podcast. It was a webinar at the time. That was, I think, after LocalStack version 2 came out, you showed me some of the new things that's been incorporated into LocalStack 2. And I'm sure people that are listening to this podcast are probably familiar with LocalStack already. It's been, you guys has been around the block for quite a while, and I've used it, I guess, way back, maybe 6 years ago, back when it was, I think, still version 1 or before that even. And you guys have come a really long way since those days. And what you showed me in the version 2, I think, has been was quite impressive. The fact that you support a lot of the IAM stuff nowadays as well, and also much broader support of the APIs. But then not long after we spoke last time, LocalStack version 3 came out. So I wanted to bring you back and do another session with you and see what's changed in the version 3 and maybe get you to maybe demo some of the things that you can do in version 3 and how that's, I guess, how that changes to your workflow as a serverless developer, in terms of the things you can do locally nowadays. So before getting to it, want to just quickly introduce yourself?
Absolutely, yeah. Thanks for setting the stage. So my name is Waldemar, CTO and co-founder here at LocalStack. Been with the project basically from the early days when it started as an open source project back in 2017, around that time frame. So might have been the time when you were, last using some of the very early versions. We were a long time. We were actually, in version 1.0, but then. Around 2.5 years, 3 years ago, we actually started building a team, a company around LocalStack, and now we have it's an innovation engine. There's a lot of cool new things coming out, and very, very excited to share some of the updates today.
Yeah, it definitely felt like it was pre-version 1 because it was far less stable compared to today. And I remember we had problems where it would just break and for no reason. And we would spend a couple of days just trying to figure out what's going on. And it always results in just someone having to just restart from scratch, just uninstall and start from scratch again. Nowadays, it feels much more stable. And from what you showed me as well, there's also much more, much more complete support of the different services and APIs.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, again, if I just look back at 5-6 years in the past, I mean, back then we, like, the LocalStack startup took like 10-15 seconds because we were, everything was really slow back in the days. And today we have a much faster plugin loading where all the code basically gets loaded asynchronously or lazily, basically, whenever it's requested first time. So there's lots of performance enhancement that we're building into the platform on an ongoing basis. We also constantly add new service providers, especially in the AWS space. We'll show today also, for example, Step Functions. We recently released a completely new rewrite of the service provider, which results in hugely optimized and better performance and more lightweight image size also of the LocalStack image. Definitely excited to dive in into the more detail.
And just a note for anyone who's listening on the Spotify or any of the podcast platforms, we're going to be showing a lot of demos in this particular episode. So it would be really much better for you if you just jump to YouTube and use the link below and watch the YouTube recording instead. Waldemar, you said that you prepared some slides as well as some demos. So do you want to bring up your screen so we can have a look and see what talking points you have prepared for us?
Yeah, perfect. Absolutely. Let me go ahead and share my screen here, and then we can show a couple of demos. As usual, hopefully the demo gods are going to be with us, but we'll see about that. Super excited to share a couple of updates. And as usual, Jan, please feel free to jump in anytime. Obviously, this is more conversational, but I'll have some slides to share, and then we can dive into different topics. So V3 was released a couple of months ago, and it really adds sort of a new milestone to our journey. So if you look back at sort of the early days of LocalStack, which we already discussed, it was the product started to be pretty successful in the open source over especially the time frame 2018, 2020, 2021. But really, from a product feature perspective, it's not, you can't even compare to what LocalStack is today, right? So there's been almost like an exponential development in new features and functionality. So right now, basically, this last milestone we added was in November 2023, shortly after reInvent. Actually shortly before reInvent. And then we also had a booth at reInvent, which was a great way to interact with the community. I think some of the numbers here speak for themselves. So the community is certainly growing on GitHub. We have a growing number of Docker pulls on a daily basis, and also quite an active Slack community that I work with on a daily basis.
Okay, so the numbers are quite impressive, but looking at your timeline there, version 1, July 2022, version 2 is March 2023, and version 3 came out in November 2023. So now we're looking at a gap of maybe a major release, a major version release every 6 to 7 months. So while that's quite impressive in terms of the evolution of the platform, but also as a user, it feels quite scary that there's a new major version, which kind of says to me that there are breaking changes. And that kind of sounds to me like, okay, if I'm going to be using LocalStack every 6 to 7 months, I have to do some work myself to get to the newer version. What are these really breaking changes? Or are they really major version updates? What's the sort of upgrade path for someone who's right now using, say, version 2?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, partially those are breaking changes, especially when we introduce entirely new service implementations. Like, for example, as I mentioned with step functions, we have a completely new implementation. S3 provider has been completely rewritten. Lambda, there has been a big push that was actually pre version 3, that was already in version 2. So for the most part, we try to keep the update path pretty seamless. So there's obviously for each of the services some configuration options. In version 3, there were some networking enhancements and changes that were also part of the breaking changes. So I guess there was quite a bit of churn in the code base over the last, especially 1.5, 2 years, which kind of necessitated a bit like these frequent major updates, major releases. But I agree with you. It's certainly something that will maybe stabilize a bit over time with less frequent major releases that we're pushing out.
Okay, sure. Okay, so now with that in mind, to continue.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's great point for sure. I just wanted to briefly showcase this here because it's really been an absolute blast to attend reInvent for the first time. You can see us here, some of us at the booth, had a lot of fun showing demos to the community, lots of great interactions with customers, users, AWS heroes, community builders. So definitely. Find us there next time, and it's been absolutely fantastic, and thanks so much for all the feedback to everybody there. In terms of V3, and this part of the slide deck is actually also taken from our 3.0 community event that we had back in, I believe, December, which is highlighted a few of the updates, and then I also added a few new slides towards the end. So we definitely had a lot of features and feedback around advanced features that enterprises are really needing, right, in their day-to-day workflows. So things like chaos engineering, for example, is an area we invested quite a bit. I have a short demo on this afterwards. Being able to inject errors, latencies into the stack and see how your application reacts to that. A lot of work around IAM. We already briefly touched upon this, but we actually further enhanced the IAM support and have a bunch of really cool new features. We go also a bit beyond local. So we have started experimenting with ephemeral cloud sandboxes, which is something that allows users to spin up a local stack hosted sandbox, if you will, that doesn't run on your local machine, but it runs in a hosted remote environment. And then obviously have lots of enhancements for the different services in the core emulator. Some of the services I already mentioned, but more to follow soon. And then also we're increasingly adding new emulators and also extensions. So I'm going to briefly touch upon, if we have some time towards the end, around a new emulator that we put out there for Snowflake. So we are also expanding into sort of the data landscape and data pipelines and how we can facilitate these pipelines locally and in CI.
Okay, I think the last one is really, really interesting, and I definitely see a space for the for something like this, because obviously people don't just use AWS. They use AWS with lots of other external services, and those services are often really difficult to test. I almost feel like I probably need something like LocalStack for those services more so than I do for AWS, because I've kind of worked out how to do, you know, testing locally, but you know, talking to remote AWS services, but yeah, those are usually more difficult with third-party services that I'm using. So super interesting about what you guys are doing in that space. But also tell us about why you're going into the space for chaos engineering, and maybe some of the, if you've got something prepared already, then maybe we can see some of the examples of what are the sort of things you can sort of do with chaos engineering here.
Yeah, 100%. I have a short sample prepared that we can look into in just a second. But basically, it's sort of expanding beyond the happy path testing that is kind of, you know, the plain vanilla type of testing that is happening, you know, on a daily basis. But then sometimes it can be helpful to sprinkle, you know, certain chaos over your tests, integration tests, right? Because, I mean, there's a certain class of failures that are just inherent to the services, like things like a throttling or rate limiting of a DynamoDB or Kinesis, for example. Those are really actually functionalities provided by the services themselves. But there's also, in some cases, outages that are happening in AWS. It's very infrequent. It's not happening frequently, but it's good to be able to test something like an entire region goes down, or maybe Lambda has some 500 errors and hiccups, right? So those kind of situations are pretty easy for us to test. And we've seen, especially with larger organizations doing disaster recovery exercises, that it becomes really useful to have this encoded as a repeatable chaos engineering test suite. More on that later, maybe it becomes...
I think that's super interesting because... I guess the complexity of orchestrating and the risk involved with and also doing a chaos experiment safely has been one of the barriers of entry for, you know, companies that want to do chaos engineering. I should also start by saying that the chaos engineering is not just about failure testing your infrastructure. It's there's multiple layers to, you know, chaos engineering. There's part of that is testing your infrastructure. Part of that is testing your human processes and your playbook, your runbook. So whether or not you have the processes and the people that are trained well enough to handle those failures, as well as your system's ability to automatically recover from these failures. So what we're talking about here is chaos engineering applied to the system level, not the sort of the human wetware on top of that. But still, it's, you know, this, if you can do a lot of chaos experiments before you even get into a real cloud environment, I can see that and how valuable that is. But I guess the thing that I have, slight concern about is that the reason why you want to do chaos engineering and test your failure cases in the real AWS environment is because you're depending on behavior that are specific to the implementation of that cloud provider. And so if we are doing chaos experiments with LocalStack, are we not testing according to the failure behaviors specific to the implementation of LocalStack, as opposed, which can be different from the real AWS services?
I agree. So first of all, to your first point, definitely we're focused on the technical aspects, but I agree that also the human aspect is super interesting, but that is a bit out of scope here. Also, this is anything around pre-production. I know that there's also a work stream or a whole industry around chaos engineering of runtime, like production systems, right? Here we're really more concerned about the development cycle and testing. Maybe, again, I think we'll maybe become a bit more concrete, and we can maybe talk about a specific sample once we get there. Because here, this is really focusing on certain functionality or errors that can actually happen in the real system as well, and being able to architect your application in a resilient way, and then also having testing around that to make sure that it actually behaves as expected.
Okay, sure. Let's look into that later.
Absolutely. Cool. So just moving ahead a bit. So what's new in V3? So this is actually a lot of details can also be found in the in the GA announcement release blog that we put out back again, it was in November. Since then, we actually had two more minor releases, 3.1 and 3.20. Some of the details I'm sharing here also basically, you can read up more details on the announcement blog as well, which is a great read. So there's been a couple of updated emulators, among them being S3. We essentially did almost like a complete rewrite, a lot of like increased parity, a lot of performance enhancements, the way how we sort of handle files. Previously, a lot of the files were basically just kept in memory, and now we have like spooled temporary files that flush to disk in regular intervals. So it's much optimized for performance. Step functions, as I mentioned, we have a separate slide on that in next. And also Elastic Cache, there have been a bunch of enhancements around cluster mode and just better configuration of Redis clusters, for example, on the local machine. Those are actually just three highlights that we put out there. There's actually much, much more in the release, but those are some of the key ones that we explicitly highlighted also in the release notes. So specifically when it comes to step functions, I think it's this has been really an interesting journey and investment. So we previously used the AWS provided step functions local Java framework or library, which you're probably familiar with. And one of the issues we were hitting there is that these zip files, these jar files were getting pretty big, right? So we actually had in the last local stack version, we had version 1.09 of step functions, which already had 46 megabytes. That's still acceptable, right? But we generally try to keep the image, Docker image, as slim as possible. And some of the latest step functions local versions have more than 440 megabytes. And this is really sort of was the incentive for us to say, okay, no, this is simply getting out of hand here. We need to do something about this. And we basically wrote an entirely new provider from scratch in Python itself. This is currently around 4.6 megabytes. So it's basically almost like a 100 times X sort of decrease in size. It is an interesting implementation. So we're actually using an Antler parser generator. We defined a whole grammar for the states language, the Amazon states language, and also contributed that grammar to actually the open source Antler repository. So big kudos to our team for putting it out there. Two of our team members have been very actively involved in this. And again, it's something we've developed out there in the open source, and also the grammar is available. So pretty excited about that. The other thing that this new provider gives us is it's very much future-proof from the way we envision step functions debugging also in the future. So you know that we have the web user interface, right, where we have our resource browsers, which we'll take a look at in a second. And part of our vision there is to really have a visual step function debugger that allows you to set, you know, things like breakpoints and so on the local machine. It is something that's partly already available in the AWS console, so we can take some inspiration from there, but we really see a lot of opportunity here to do visual inspection of your step function workflows, and you know, even again, different testing scenarios where in certain steps or branches you can inject potentially even errors and things like that, right?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I recently put out a blog post about the comparing lambda, you know, putting workflows in the lambda function versus putting them inside a step function. And one of the things that you get with lambda is that you can, you know, put a breakpoint in your code. So for something that's more complicated, it's easy to step through it. And of course, if you're using step functions, if you're using a lambda function as part of a state, a task state, you can still put breakpoints, but only for that particular step, as opposed to the entire workflow. And that's something that a lot of people have asked for. And personally, I would love to be able to, and that's something that I think step functions is missing right now, that the ability to use mocking natively without using step functions local, because they've got this new test state API, which is great, but it doesn't quite give you the ability to do a mocking that you had with step functions local.
Super interesting. Yeah, no, that's great feedback. And actually, I think I saw the blog post that you put out there, and also the LinkedIn post recently. Yeah, I think there's a lot of step functions really has its place. We're also using it in our own backend infrastructure for, you know, keeping transactional workflows more different types. Like, it's just great to as an orchestration engine. And I think there's a lot of need for testing these kind of flows that are running in step functions. So yeah, very excited to maybe get your feedback and iterate on this in the upcoming releases and versions. Awesome, yeah, very cool. So the other point we just really briefly want to touch upon is our networking initiative. So we, generally speaking, LocalStack, the plain vanilla deployment is on Docker, on the local machine. As you can imagine, like networking is one of the key points that has been maybe a bit tricky in the past. So we added a whole lot of different configuration options. So for configuring ports, Docker networks, the way how hosts are being resolved between containers and so on. And what we're also increasingly seeing is that users are deploying LocalStack also in other environments. For example, Podman is becoming more and more interesting and important. Kubernetes, a lot of larger orgs are standardizing on Kubernetes as a deployment platform, especially for their CI/CD pipelines. So we had to do a bunch of unification of the whole networking stack and introduce abstractions to make things more cross-compatible. And one of the key ingredients here is that we have this canonical host name, localhost, localstack.cloud, which is actually a host name you can resolve publicly in the public DNS. It has 127.0.0.1. There's also an SSL certificate that's valid for this name and subdomains. But the thing is that within the new LocalStack environment, this host name resolves to different IP addresses depending on where the request is coming from, right? So our DNS server can basically observe the request, see where it's coming from, and then resolve, give different answers back to the client, basically, right? So to make sure that from every context, you always can always call home, call back to the main LocalStack container, which is important for things like Lambda, ECS, where we have separate containers that need to talk back to the main APIs. And we also sort of streamlined and simplified a lot the configuration options. There's now basically two main ones. One is LocalStack host. So that's basically the host name you define where the client can contact LocalStack. And gateway listen is basically the address or set of addresses where LocalStack binds its network ports to, right? So this is more sort of the runtime initialization, and LocalStack host is kind of the client configuration to make sure that you can actually talk to the right host. So again, and this is where sort of the breaking changes with 3.0 are coming in, because a lot of the standardization around these two main environment variables was meant that customers maybe had to redefine their Docker Compose files or custom scripts. But yeah, things are now getting much more streamlined and easier for users. Things work out of the box and just work, essentially, for the most part. Cool. Yeah, so then we also spent quite a bit of time in like a new desktop app experience. We'll actually see in just a few minutes the web application of LocalStack, and there's also a downloadable desktop version that is now available for the major operating systems, and also a fully code signed version that's available in the respective marketplaces. So again, something that we see, even though the web version is also great, but some customers just prefer to have like a downloadable version that you can run on your desktop. All right, so I guess I'm just gonna continue talking through these points here. Just feel free to chime in anytime. We already briefly mentioned the parts on the core emulator sides that was mentioning. We also have a bunch of innovations happening on the platform side, our cloud offering, right? So one of them is, as briefly mentioned before, ephemeral environments, which give you a way to preview application states and share the states, really having these sandbox environments of LocalStack. And then we're also adding more functionality around just CI integrations, right? So if you run LocalStack builds in your CI pipelines, having telemetry and analytics in terms of, okay, which APIs are being called? Are there any successes or failure responses? And just getting more debuggability and insights into CI. And I think we partially covered that also in the last webinar, if you remember, with Lumigo, but we've sort of, we keep adding more functionality here as well on the platform.
Yeah, it was pretty cool that you were able to integrate Lumigo with your local environment, so you can actually use the Lumigo to monitor and observe and troubleshoot your problems that's happening on your local simulator. So tell me a bit more about ephemeral environments, because that is something that I do all the time, and it's something that I actually teach a lot in my courses and workshops. But creating ephemeral environments in the AWS So how does your implementations kind of differ from that?
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think the concept of VM environments has really picked up traction in the last couple of years in the industry. I think there's several manifestations of that. So certainly in a real AWS environment, it would be, for example, if you have your stack defined as, for example, CloudFormation or Terraform, you could just spin up the entire stack, maybe some Lambdas, some containers, some databases, run your tests, and then basically tear everything down, and then it's basically, your resources are cleaned up again. In the context of LocalStack, an ephemeral environment specifically is actually a hosted LocalStack environment, a hosted LocalStack instance that runs in a cloud VM, and we manage the deployment of these VMs, and then you get an endpoint URL that you can then interact with. We'll also cover this shortly in the demos. And if you sort of take the idea further, you can almost say that almost every CI build is also usually creating ephemeral environments or some sort of ephemeral state where you can run your tests if you have a very sort of sophisticated automated test setup. But I think, again, in our more specific case, what we're referring to is these hosted sandbox instances that are running in a cloud VM, which we'll I'll show in just a bit. How do you sort of approach and teach ephemeral environments? What's your recommendation there?
So I tend to just with tools like Server Framework, there's a built-in sort of notion of a stage. So creating a new ephemeral environment is just going to be as simple as a serverless deploy, dash S to give it a stage name, and that name could be the name of your feature branch or what have you. And the same thing can be done with SAM. The same thing can be done with CDK. So you're basically just creating a copy of your stack. Depending on what you use, if you're using just serverless components like DynamoDB, Lambda, API Gateway, there's no uptime cost, then you can create as many of these resources or these environments technically as you need until you run into the resource limits. But when you're using server full resources that are charged by uptime, things like RDS and things like that, then it requires a little bit more of a workaround to actually share those instances, just so that you don't have hundreds copies of RDS running around or charging you uptime. There's also some stuff that you have to do around SSM parameters. So if you're using SSM parameters to share information between different stack, so the platform team will create some resources like VPC networking stuff, and then it would tell the application team, okay, here's VPC ID, here's the subnet ID, and so on. People often share those as SSM parameters. So rather than having to duplicate SSM parameters for every single environment, I can also just introduce a new variable called SSM parameter name, so that I can say, here's my environment name called feature local stack version 3, but then use the SSM environment name called dev, so that I will use the same SSM parameters from the main dev environment. So that's how I tend to do my ephemeral environments in AWS. So that way I can just bring up a new environment when I'm working on a feature. I'll do all of my deployments and the testing in that environment. And then when it's done, when I create a PR, I would just run delete and destroy the environment. And I can use the same technique during a CI/CD pipeline, so that when you have this commit that you've done, it would run the tests and all of that in CI/CD pipeline against a temporary environment that's created just for that CI/CD run. That way, it doesn't pollute any of your main environment with test data. And that's something that I think a lot of companies have sort of run into problems. So they end up writing a script that just clean the environment every month or so, and I've seen that a lot. So using ephemeral environments for this kind of temporary things that you're doing, like CI/CD pipeline and so on, running tests, I think that will keep your environments much cleaner.
Absolutely, yeah. I think it was a great summary. Yeah, I think this is really the prime use case that we also see a lot for these types of environments, that you have some kind of an automation already that allows you to spin up a stack, right? And then either in your case, it would be sort of the real environment, the real AWS. And then what we do is basically just spinning up a container and then almost give you an empty AWS account that you can then sort of later tear down again, right, as part of the container destruction. But yeah, super powerful concept. And I think a lot of it is already about the engineering rigor behind this, right? Making sure that you actually have these tests in place, these pipelines, the automation, the repeatability. And then sort of, I would almost say like which environment you use behind the scenes is almost a technicality. I think it's really more about the, having this engineering rigor of testing frequently and on every change, essentially. Okay, cool. No, that's great. Great discussion. So just to move on a bit, so another service we're quite excited about is Event Bridge Pipe. So this is actually something that is more one of the new services. The first version came out with 3.1 just a couple of weeks ago. And it's been one of the most upvoted features in our feature tracker on GitHub. So a lot of users really were excited to get a first version of this. And basically, you're probably familiar with the service. Basically, you know, you have event sources that can consist of, things like databases, SQS queues, topics, and so on. And then there's some filtering mechanism and enrichment in place. And then you can sort of pump that these data items to targets, like, again, a database or something like a stream where you can then sort of do further processing downstream. So this is something we're very actively building out. So far, we have support for certain combinations of sources and targets, including SNS, SQS, DynamoDB streams, and others. And we'd really very much love to get the feedback from the community on how that's working, which additional use cases we can build out there. Have you had much chance to play with Event Bridge Pipes yet?
Yeah, I have. I had put a few things into production with Event Bridge Pipes, and you removed some of the custom code I had. I even had this plugin that creates this server firmware plugin that basically can create a Lambda function that connects DynamoDB stream to forgot what it was to Event Bridge. So essentially, I've got something that turns DynamoDB events into Event Bridge events, and so Event Bridge Pipes kind of now doing that for you. So I was able to just get rid of that whole thing and just replace it with a few lines of CloudFormation to put in the Event Bridge Pipes instead of this custom serverless firmware plugin.
Awesome.
And I'd like to see more things that's been supported by the Event Bridge Pipes. Right now, it feels like just a small set of targets and the sources. It's useful. But then there's also the whole no code ETL thing they introduced as well at the reInvent. The thing that connects, for example, I think DynamoDB to OpenSearch is quite interesting one. That's again something that a lot of people use. But it's interesting that they put that as a separate thing as opposed to turn it into, dress it up as an event bridge pipe. So, it's, you've got different ways to connect different services depending on what the source and destinations are. I guess it's probably because it's worked on by different teams, but it feels a little bit disjointed in that, I want to have like one way that connects, that gives me no code connection between different kind of event sources and targets. I like Event Bridge Pipes. It's nice. I wish that they have more things like this.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It's a very powerful service, and we see in our implementation some similarities in the event sources, for example, with Lambda event source mappings. So actually on the code level, we're able to unify a couple of these source mapping logic that is common and kind of similar across different services. But totally agree with you that typical AWS phenomenon, right, that different teams are doing things slightly differently. Okay, great. Yeah, definitely looking forward to getting more feedback on pipes as we build this out further with the community. So if you want to switch gears a bit, we can dive into a couple of demos. And again, let's see how far we get. I've prepared two or three, and I would like to first dive a bit into IAM policy stream. So IAM is generally something that we've built quite a lot of innovations around because we just realized that it's a bit of a pain to work with IAM, especially coming from a previous version of LocalStack that did not have IAM enforcement enabled, and you basically just deployed your app into AWS and then suddenly you needed all these permissions and policies. And things like policies should also be least privileged, right? So there's a whole set of best practices around what actually constitutes a well-written policy. In general, what we also discover is that it tends to maybe slow developers down a bit if you're working with a new service. Obviously, thinking security and IAM as first principle is important, but you have to make yourself, you familiarize yourself with the different resource identity-based policies and so on. And one pretty interesting point is that the enforcement is not always visible or even inspectable from the outside. So a lot of that is black box, and I'll show in just a second what we mean by that. So we've invested quite heavily into IAM enforcement in general, and specifically also a new feature that we call IAM policy stream, which is quite nice. It sort of generates the policies that you require on the fly. So I've actually taken a sample here that one of our team members, Daniel, who's been very much actively involved in the development of this, and he also showed this demo and in the last 3.0 release community event. And I thought it was a really nice example that showcases the functionality here. So let's assume you have an SNS topic, right, that's connected to an SQS queue, so fairly common pattern. And so if you basically deploy this into a real AWS account without sort of the required policies, then the integration can just fail silently, right? So you push in a message into the topic, and it simply never arrives at the queue because the topic lacks the permission to actually forward the item there. And it's something that can be pretty hard to figure out, honestly, because, you know, I think there's maybe some logs in CloudTrail where you can take a look, but it's not always straightforward to debug issues like that, where there is some permission issues that basically break some of the integrations. So there's a short sample that we can briefly showcase, and I'm going to switch to my terminal here for some of these demos. So hopefully hopefully you can actually read the font. Is it big enough? I think it's all right.
Yeah, I can see it. It's a lot of text, though, so you have to maybe walk me through what we're looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely we'll walk through, yeah. So basically, the way we start the IAM enforcement is with this enforce IAM equals one feature flag. So this is basically a configuration that we set in LocalStack to start the IAM engine, essentially, to basically start the enforcement.
Okay. And you have to do that when you start the LocalStack.
Yes, exactly. So by default, it's actually disabled, you can enable it with this feature flag. So you have to basically configure it at startup. Okay, so I have this small example here. Let me just switch to my IDE here real quick for this short demo. So what we're going to do is to basically follow these steps here. So we're going to first create a topic, right? An SNS topic with the name test topic. And by the way, so we're using the AWS local command here, which is just a drop-in replacement for the AWS CLI that talks to LocalStack directly. So we create a queue here. You can actually see the requests coming through. And there's actually already some IAM policy engine messages that you can see here with the context for this action with certain properties that are attached to the context. We can now subscribe the queue to the topic, right? So just using the SNS subscribe command. And now, basically, what we'll do next is we'll publish a message to the topic itself, right? So, and obviously, as we have the integration, we would expect that the message arrives from the SNS in topic in the SQS queue. But what we see here is actually an error. We get an access denied error and say, it says, this user, in this case, is the SNS principal, service principal, is not authorized to a send message on this resource, right? Mm-hmm. So it gives you fairly detailed insights into what is actually missing in a particular integration between services. So this failed. So if we try to get the message from the queue, obviously there would be nothing in there. So it's just going to return an empty result. So nothing's in there. So what we can now do is we can basically update the IAM policy of that of the queue to enable access to an SNS topic to forward messages there, right? I've already prepared an attributes JSON here that's basically just the policy language, right? So it is effect allow for send message on this particular resource under this principle, right? Under the condition.
And the principle is the SNS service, and condition is that it has to come from that particular queue that we just created.
Yeah, okay. Exactly, 100%. Right. The JSON is here just encoded as a string, but I hope we were able to read that. Right. So if we then run basically this update command, right? So if we go back here and I just do a set queue attributes with this attributes file. Now basically the policy has been enabled for the queue, and we can then sort of do another publish to the topic. And this time it actually went through, right? So we're not seeing any error messages anymore here, and we can receive the message from the queue itself. Right. So this is a sort of simple example where we see, okay, having integration between the two services, one service is trying to call another. That's happening more and more frequently as we have more integrations between services. You know, also if a Lambda function, for example, is trying to access a DynamoDB table or something like that, right? There's a lot of integrations between services. And this explainable IAM, as we call it, gives us some really detailed insights into what's happening here.
Yeah, I think the more sort of synchronous aspects of, say, like a Lambda function talking to DynamoDB, those are fairly easy to debug because you get the logs in your Lambda function log group, so you can see that those are usually quite easy to debug. But it's more the sort of asynchronous things that are happening between different services that you don't get the logs for, say, SQS or SNS. You have to enable those, you have to get them delivered to the right place, and you know to look for them. And there's multiple sort of ifs that have to be true for you to actually figure out, okay, the problem that I'm not getting the messages is because my queue my topic is missing the permission. So this definitely looks really, really interesting, especially for debugging some of this integration between when using services like event bridge pipes, more of the no-code solutions that are doing all the data transfer, shuffling for you. I think this is where the permission stuff is going to be much harder to debug without something like this.
Yep. Absolutely, 100%. Yeah, totally. We actually see another example just in a bit where we have a user level error in a Lambda. This, as you mentioned, this is going to be a bit more straightforward to debug there. But I think it's really interesting for especially these inter-service integrations. One thing I wanted to mention, because now what we saw is the IAM enforcement, and I'm basically switching over to our web UI here. And I think I just realized this is the first time in this session that I'm showing the web app. So this is app.localstack.cloud. I'm logged in here with my profile, and this is really the entry point, the portal into sort of a lot of functionality that we expose through the UI. And we have this one section here is called IAM policy stream, and the cool part is here now. That as we were running this experiment or this sample, it was actually showing us the policy and the endpoints that were required for this particular calls, right? So basically what I added before in the predefined JSON that I already had in the attributes file, we could have also just extracted it from here, because LocalStack observed, okay, there's a request being made to SQS and you need this particular policy in order to enable this call, right?
Okay.
Just to sort of close the loop on the, this is what we call the IAM policy stream that actually generates policies as you make requests to the system.
Okay, so the workflow here is that I will say start local stack, and then I will run my suite of tests. And then at the end of that, some of the tests may fail, and I can come here, I can look at the summary policy and see, okay, I'm missing some IAM permissions, I'm missing some resource policies, and then I can then turn this, use this, and then go back to my code to figure out, okay, where do I put this resource policy, for example, and fix it that way.
100%, yeah, exactly. So in fact, if we just did like a very quick restart of LocalStack here, let me just restart with, and again, I am enforcement enabled, create our queue, create our topic, create topic, and then we can actually already see in the stream the requests coming through here, right? So LocalStack is observing what's happening, and then if I do the subscribe operation, and then publish, then we actually see the IAM violation that you actually see right here, right? So it actually really shows you there was an error in this call. Right. You actually need this particular policy here enabled for your scenario. So yeah, but totally to your point, really sort of an enable for, especially for these inter-service integrations where it can sometimes be a bit hard to figure out what's actually going on behind the scenes, right, in real areas.
Cool, that's very nice.
Cool. Sweet. So this is kind of IAM. And again, we have a lot of ongoing enhancements there. Also, the way how we integrate it into things like infrastructures, code frameworks like Terraform, for example. And there's a whole bunch of work that we're doing to make it even more seamless and expose it there. Cool. So I guess since time is always short, let's switch maybe to next demo, which would be around chaos engineering, right? So we briefly touched upon this already. And here we're really focusing on the technical aspects of this. And more specifically, let's assume you have a simple, serverless app like this one here, where you have an API gateway, maybe some Lambda functions, and then a DynamoDB table, fairly simple setup. And then, as you well know, in DynamoDB, you get certain sort of errors that can happen on the API layer, things like rate limiting, right? So provision throughput exceeded exception, or sometimes there might even be like errors, just internal server errors in the service itself, right? That's not something that's happening very frequently, but there can be certain error conditions on your table that the client needs to be aware of. And then one way to handle this, for example, is to provide resiliency in your application, where the handler would maybe catch any exceptions, put them into a topic in a queue, and then sort of later on a downstream asynchronous Lambda would pick those up and just do some retries on the inserts, right? For example, on the put operations. So this is something, and again, having a way to test this is something that can be really beneficial. And that's why one of the features that we're providing here is a way to simulate outages, errors, and also latency conditions. So I want to briefly showcase this. And by the way, a lot of the samples that I'm showing here are actually available in our, let me just quickly go to our docs.localstack.cloud. So that's a great reference for anything you'd like to explore, especially, for example, if you look for chaos engineering here, then we have, here in the fault injection simulator experiments, you'll actually find a link to a sample application repository. And this basically showcases the example I want to quickly run through now. So you can see the same type of architecture figure here. And usually they are easy to set up, something like a CDK or a Terraform configuration. And we can just briefly run through this this example here now. So let me just restart LocalStack here. This time I'll just start it without IAM enforcement, just basically default setup. And in this terminal here on the right-hand side, I have a small script prepared that will actually walk us through the creation of this particular sample app that we just saw. Let's take a look at that here. I have this in my FIS experiments in its resources. So that's the script we're going to run now. I'll just let that run in the background. Resources. And basically what it does is, it creates all these resources, right? The DynamoDB table, the Lambdas. One of them is called the get product Lambda. That is an API gateway. And we're getting the resources for the API gateway, put the methods in there. Do some operations on updating, just some query string modifications. So a lot of these are just manual steps with the AWS CLI that we're running here. Could also be a Terraform or some different script. But in this case, we just, for simplicity, provided this with AWS commands. All right, so this is now deployed here in the background. And what we can now do is, basically, we can now make a request to this to the API gateway, which serves the request via a Lambda function. But let's now enable the chaos mode, right? So we want to inject errors into our DynamoDB service and then see how the application actually reacts to that. So what I'm going to do here is I'll go to chaos engineering. So this is a whole section in our web UI. It's also accessible programmatically, so you can either do it through the UI or via some API calls. And I'm going to scroll down here and go to this DynamoDB error section, and we can specify a fault probability here. I'm just going to say 100%. So all the requests to DynamoDB are basically now going to fail. And what I'll do now is, I think I have this somewhere in my history here, we can do a request.
What is it going to fail with?
Good point. So in this particular case, it's going to fail with a... provision throughput exceeded exception. So this is basically the that the read or write throughput has basically been exceeded. So we're
right.
We're simulating a situation of high load on the DynamoDB table, which then refuses any additional API calls, and you have to wait a couple of seconds or minutes to run the request again.
Okay, good. Because this is one of the things that I find very difficult to actually test. And there's one of the things that I normally have to use mocks, just because with my remote code and end-to-end tests, I can't reliably make it throw this particular error. And so I end up having to rely on using mocks to test my code against this particular use case.
Yeah, exactly. So this is definitely something that I think it's pretty, like, and these errors really do happen, right? So here we're not talking about some obscure problem that might occur once in a while. Like these provision throughput exceptions, depending on how your table is set up, they do actually happen at runtime. So you really need to, I mean, there are some retries enabled in the SDK, and we'll actually see this in just a second. So let me just run this curl command here, which basically just runs against this execute API, which is the API gateway endpoint, some payload to add this right. to the database. And so this is the Lambda code starts in the background, is now creating the task container. The Lambda is running, and we can actually see now provision throughput exceptions coming through, right? So let me just scroll up here again in the logs. We saw, search for it here, provision throughput exception. Yeah, so, and okay. The SDK is actually performing some retries under the covers, a certain amount, so I think 3 or 4 retries, and then it basically gives up and traces the error back to the Lambda runtime. And in this case, we actually had in our Lambda a try catch, which then handles this error and puts the message to SQS, right, for later processing.
Right. And is this a JavaScript or is this Python?
No, this is actually written in Java itself.
Okay. Oh no, so, it's in the Lambda function that you were running.
Exactly. So the Lambda function that we're running here, this is actually written in Java. And we see here is doing a put item request, right? And then we are catching DynamoDB exceptions, the one that we saw as a subclass of this. And then it's basically saying message sent to queue, right? Basically, it's just publishing the message to a dead data queue, or like this queue that picks him up from there.
Right. Okay. And in your local simulator, you're also enforcing the Lambda timeout setting.
Yeah, so we have a timeout. That's actually a great point. So the if we go to init resources here, they have a timeout value defined. So in this case, we just set 45 seconds. Can also be, I think the other one had 20 seconds. Yeah, so we have full emulation of the timeouts as well.
Okay, that's cool. Because one of the things that often this kind of provisions throughput exception doesn't always manifest in the actual error in your Lambda function, because like I said, SDK has got a retry, but it will often manifest certainly in JavaScript is that the JavaScript SDK has got, I think, a default of 10 retries with exponential backoff in between. So you often get a timeout instead of an actual Lambda function error because of DynamoDB throughput exceptions. Instead of manifesting into like a timeout for your function instead, until you look into the X-ray trace or something like that, and see that you're making multiple calls to DynamoDB and it keeps failing. So this is something that I guess that can help you catch that easier, because you're going to see your function timeout, but then you're going to see in your local stack logs that there's like a bunch of throughput exceeded exceptions in the logs once your function was retrying.
Yeah, exactly. And depending on how the function is configured, so for example, if it has an event source mapping, if the Lambda fails, it would actually get respawned with the same event, right? So there's some built-in error handling mechanisms that would kick in both if the error is propagated or if it times out, right? So, but yeah, there's definitely, and this I think really showcases like how important it is to test these different scenarios and use cases for real world applications. So now let me quickly switch back to the to close the loop. I'll go to our DynamoDB resource browser, and just to quickly show, I think this is also the first time that we show our resource browser, which has all the different services here. And for example, DynamoDB is one of them, right? So we can just go here, and we now see the table that was created locally. By the way, this web application is a hosted app, but it's actually connecting to my local instance on localhost. So no outbound connectivity to a cloud system. And we see here the products table, and I cannot just go here and do a scan on it. So if I just go to items and do a scan, it's basically empty right now. And what we can now do is, as this is still running, we're going to stop the experiment, basically go back to zero fault probability, update this here. And by the way, this was actually also retrying, right? Because
because it was failing as well.
but now the request was coming through, and the reason why is because the SQS had an event source mapping that was continuous. If you go back to our architecture diagram, this was continuously being respawned, this lambda, and trying to add the item. And once we lifted the error, it actually went through, and now the update has happened eventually, right? So again, so this kind of nicely showcases how you can create these resilient applications and also test them end to end in your local environment there.
That's very cool. That's very cool. And I also saw you had some simulation for latency and a few other things as well besides the throughput error.
Yes, absolutely. So there's the same basically goes for Kinesis, for example.
Okay.
You can add latencies to this. Again, this is like this.
To specific services here. Or to everything?
I mean, in this particular case, it's for everything. Okay. We also have some more fine-grained control, but in the UI, not everything is exposed. And then there's also things where, for example, you can say an entire region goes down, right? You can say US East 1 or US West 2 goes down, and you can simulate those as well.
Or if your whole service goes down.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. If the whole, like literally the whole AWS API control plane goes down, right? The entire service.
Okay.
Yeah, now that's something that we're definitely quite excited about, especially if you think about the some of the testing implications of this. There's a few more examples. For example, on this slide here, we also applied this to several other services. For example, in RDS, we have a way to do global cluster failover, or in Route 53, we actually added support for DNS-based failover. So you can actually have if a client makes a request, let's assume you have a replicated service that sits in two regions, right? US East 1 and US Central 1, for example, and you have a Route 53 in front of that. We can actually do health checks on these endpoints, and if one of them goes down, there's like a failover to a secondary, right? So again, a lot of these more advanced use cases that you would certainly see a lot in production environments, and we also try to enable ways to test these failover scenarios in the stack and make them part of your CI testing as well. Okay. Cool. So I guess maybe if we have a couple of minutes, the last one I wanted to briefly show is around Locustack Cloud Sandboxes, which basically is this ephemeral instance that we briefly touched upon before. Again, that's something we put out as a preview and alpha version actually in V3. And so essentially the idea is that we spin up these temporary hosted instances. We already talked about this briefly before, and then you can quickly deploy and test your changes, for example, in a CI build, right? So let's assume you have some GitHub workflow here where somebody creates a pull request, and I'm sure that maybe some of your listeners have seen this in other repositories where you then get a comment on the PR where you can then click, this is the preview that's now available for an hour or so, right? And you can actually look into like preview, especially for UI changes, it's quite relevant and significant, right? So being able to preview these changes. The way we have this enabled, it is also accessible directly from the UI or from a CLI endpoint, API endpoint. But I just want to briefly showcase what this looks like in the web UI. So I can go here to our Locustack instances tab, and there's this additional tab here that says ephemeral instances. And actually still have an old one running here. I'm just going to terminate this here real quick, start with a fresh state. So now we can say I want to create an ephemeral instance, right? Let's just call it test 1, 2, 3. And what this does now, basically in the background, it spins up a VM, a very lightweight VM that starts a Docker container that has Locustack running in it. And you get this endpoint URL here, which is now basically almost like an AWS account that you can use in all your tooling, right? So we can now see here AWS endpoint URL. Oops, URL equals this. And then I'll just do an AWS local S3LS. Before I do this, I'll actually terminate the local stack instance here to make sure that nothing's running locally anymore. So we really see that these requests are going out to the remote instance. And then initially there's nothing in there, but we can create a bucket, right? S3 test 1-3. And you just have like the full power of the local stack instance is running in a remote environment, giving you a way to test, for example, we could have deployed the application we just saw before entirely just against this ephemeral instance that's now running in this environment. So again, not something we were sort of experimenting with and getting some feedback. I guess one of the key benefits from this, as opposed to maybe using some of the approaches with tearing down CloudFormation stacks or cleaning up the resources, is cleanup of resource in our case is just remove the instance from here, right? And then obviously the container is gone and everything else as well. So I think especially from a resource cleanup point of view and lifecycle, this can simplify things in some cases quite a bit.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a good argument because I mean, for me, just one command, serverless at the remove. But I can see the argument for using this more in that you have a shared environment with your teammates where you want to do some of the testing. We talked about, like, I guess this ephemeral environment supports some of the tooling around the controlling the chaos experiments and also supports the IAM policy enforcer. Is that right?
Absolutely, 100%. Okay. So essentially everything you see in here can also be accessed. So basically the whole UI has this context and you have this context of this sandbox instance right now. And then we can just go to the S3 browser and we see what we just created before, right? So we have the same functionality. You can use cloud pods against this instance. You can do the chaos engineering, all the same functionality basically that's exposed here.
Okay. So I think that's probably more of a... The argument that would make more sense to me than this is simpler than using the cloud, especially if it's just a case of clicking a button to delete a CloudFormation stack. But what you offer is some additional capabilities that you don't get out of the box with AWS. So I think that's probably more the thing that I will that would make more sense to me to use your ephemeral environment as opposed to just using another CloudFormation stack.
Yeah. No, actually, that's a great observation, yeah, for sure, 100%. Great. So the last thing, if we have one or two more minutes,
sure.
Just really briefly touching upon, because it's something that we're quite excited about, is a sneak preview into our new local stack Snowflake emulator. So first of all, what is Snowflake? Snowflake is a cloud data platform. So here we're now stepping out of the AWS world, which is still our primary target, but Snowflake is its own ecosystem, right? It's a data platform that allows you to upload files, run SQL statements to create tables, databases, views, and so on. You can select data from your tables, run scheduled jobs to create ETL pipelines and so on. So it's a fairly active ecosystem of just data tooling. And it turns out that there is also a need for first of all testing and also a need for something like a localized version of the dev experience. So what we put out, or we set out to a journey and an adventure to actually start building a first version of a Snowflake emulator that allows you to run data pipelines on the local machine. And the nice thing about what we've built here is it works on the API level, right? So we basically emulate the Snowflake API. So we get a lot of these integrations for free and out of the box. So things like a JDBC driver, or if you have your database visualization tool, you can just use that, with the native connectivity against this emulator. So I just want to very briefly show what this looks like. I can briefly spin it up here. Shouldn't take us a minute. So this is actually using the local stack extension mechanism. So it's more of a technicality, but we basically built Snowflake as an extension that can be installed into the local stack container. And I've done it here. Now it's basically up and running. If I do a Docker PS, you actually see the local stack Snowflake image running here. And then I can switch over to my database visualization tools. So in this case, I'm using dbeaver, which is one of these popular tools. And I can go to the connection settings here. And what you'll see is we basically connect to snowflake.localhost localhost.cloud, which is our well-known local endpoint with some test connection settings, right? And we can now basically just step through these commands. And you can see here on the left-hand side in the background, there's a bunch of processing happening. So I'm just creating a table. We're inserting some Bob and Alice into the table. We're doing a select, and we actually get the results back here. And then we have even things like a support for UDFs, for user-defined functions, where you can create a JavaScript UDF, for example, that returns hello world. And we just do a select in this, and it actually executes the JavaScript behind the scenes with the input that you provide to it. So this is really more of just a first teaser, but we're quite excited and you know, working with a couple of early adopters, beta users, beta customers who are evaluating this first version of this, and we'd definitely love to get some feedback from the community and get some support from early adopters. So if anyone's out there using Snowflake and you would like to do some testing or some local execution, then please let us know.
Yeah, that looks very cool. Like I said, it totally makes a lot of sense for you to do this. I haven't done Snowflake myself, but I do know that in the past, I think I've had issues with clients because of the number of seats they have on their Snowflake account or something like that. So it wasn't easy to get access to the Snowflake environment for development. And so having this would actually be quite useful at that time as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, that's really, really good feedback. So certainly looking forward. And there's some similarities to some other big data services in AWS, which we also spend some time and effort in, which we also support Athena, Redshift, and so on. So we definitely see an increasing need also in this data space to provide some support.
Gotcha.
Okay, so just wrapping up, I mean, what's next? We're definitely focusing a lot on building out the platform, right? So both the emulator with, you know, increasing the parity of all the services that we provide, adding new services like event-bridge pipes, for example, but also looking at the end-to-end dev lifecycle with things like the ephemeral instance that we saw and, you know, some of the analytics and CI insights. We didn't have a chance to look into those today, but certainly it's sort of more and more focus on the end-to-end platform functionality to really support development and testing workflows end-to-end for cloud development. Doubling down on extensions as well. So briefly mentioned that this plugin mechanism that allows us to plug in new functionality into LocalStack. We did already receive some community contributions, which is quite exciting. There's an extension called Authress. It's an IAM policy enforcement system, and that has been contributed as an extension. And also, as mentioned, the Snowflake emulators and other things. So yeah, so definitely quite exciting months and years ahead. Big plans for this year, and I hope we're gonna have many more opportunities to catch up and in your podcast and in your show.
Yeah, likewise. This definitely has. It looks amazing. It looks really exciting. And I saw you put out something that you're looking for a developer advocate for your team. If someone is listening and looking for, you know, looking to join your team, where do they go?
Absolutely, 100%. That's awesome. Thanks so much for sharing that. So on our website, localstack.cloud, we have our careers page, careers. And we actually currently have quite a few openings. And as you mentioned, for example, the DevRel lead that we're looking for, but also several engineering roles that we're looking for, customer success managers and so on. So please do reach out anytime. You'll find us on the careers page, on our Slack channel, which is the best way to get in touch with our community as well, or also via LinkedIn and email as well.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much for coming in and showing us what's been happening with LocalStack version 3. Can't imagine how much work you guys put in to push this much stuff out in about 6 months. So, you know, good job.
big kudos to the team, especially. I mean, I have the pleasure to showcase what, you know, what the team has been putting out there, but it's a huge, immense team effort. So it's a big kudos to the team and everybody in the community as well, who's contributing to this big effort.
Yeah, best of luck, and hopefully I'll see you maybe reInvent this year.
Looking forward to it.
Take it easy. Awesome.
Again.
And thanks for listening, everyone. And I hope we'll see you guys next time. Okay. Bye-bye.
Ciao.
So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.